Hey folks, it's the unsung. It's the unsung. It's the unsung. I'm Mark, joined by this guy Chris.
It's just we Chris.
Just we Chris. I'm Chris too. And we're also joined by a guest.
Il s'appelle
Sean.
Sean Campbell.
Sean Campbell.
Sean Patrick Campbell.
Oh really?
Yeah, because there's another Sean Campbell in Glasgow who's also a photographer.
There's fucking definitely at least one more Sean Campbell in Glasgow.
But specifically, this guy's a photographer. And for the first few years that I was doing photographs, people kept messaging me on Facebook being like, hey man, nice to meet you last night. Can you come and photograph my event? And I was like, I don't know you.
yes, but it's not what you expect.
Yeah, right, exactly. So Sean Patrick Campbell to give me my full name.
That's quite funny. So I've just finished writing my first book, right? And if it does get published, it'll be under the name MD Fraser, mm-hmm. Mark David Fraser, because there's a Canadian hockey player called Mark, like NHL player called Mark Fraser.
See, so, if you're doing that though, why don't you just go like full Buna and just invent a new name?
You could, yeah.
I've done it.
I know you've
That's
done
true,
it.
True, yeah. Yes.
What is your actual
I've
name?
Actually done it multiple times. You just don't know that I've done it. You
really?
Maybe know. You definitely don't know.
No, I don't.
There's an electronic music project out there in the ether with records that is me, but under a fake name.
What?
Yeah, it's a real thing.
And he's got a catfish Facebook profile as well.
My catfish Facebook profile, which by the way has now been stolen, so if you do see it, you know, advocating Donald Trump, then give me a shout. But my catfish Facebook profile, I thought was a ridiculous name that wouldn't be an issue. It was actually, I was in a band and it was a fun band, believe it or not. You ever been in one of them? And
unheard of.
We decided, let's make this fun by having like assumed identities and sort of get away for our own po-faced names and po-faced subjects, right? And so we all came up with these daft names and mine just kind of stuck. And I used it for my Facebook because the only reason I got a Facebook was to run the band account. Mm-hmm. And ergo, that seemed a sensible thing. And then it just kind of stuck around until I met somebody with that name.
No way, really.
And I worked with him for a while. And then I just ended up getting inundated with people's fucking emails who assumed like, well, that can't possibly not be him. That must be him. We've got friends in common. And I assumed this was a safe, ridiculous name. And it turns out it's not a safe, ridiculous name.
Wow.
In the end, mate, kayfabe always dies.
Aye. She certainly does. So, Sean.
Yes.
Who are you?
So, I am a musician. Haven't made music in a while, but been in a few bands in Glasgow.
Tisha, your legacy endures.
Oh, God, yeah. My legacy of The Ocean Fracture for a clear decade.
Yep.
Then I was in a
that's
band
when I
called,
first met you.
That's right, yeah. Then I was in a band called Hunt Gather.
That's when I first met you.
That's right, yep, yep. And then Thin Privilege. Played in Bad Luck for a bit.
You played in Billy Ray Cyrus.
I did play in the 14-piece orchestra.
Yeah, who didn't really?
Who didn't? I know, exactly. That picture came up on my Facebook recently, actually.
That's
like
nice
the last couple
that.
Of days. Yeah.
Next to me advocating for Donald Trump.
And then most recently, Damn Teeth. Who are on sort of a hiatus at the minute, but we do have a new record incoming pretty soon.
I really hope that does get back on the rails, because that was a very strong project. But you're being too humble, because you're also a photographer of some renown.
I don't know about renown, but yeah, I'm a photographer as well. Yeah, since 2015-ish.
How would you describe your style of photography? Because I think your stuff's really quite distinct.
Okay.
But I'd
thanks.
Be curious to see how you would summarise it.
Sad and boring to the ends of transcendental. So that's
to me, your work looks like a whole series of potential Godspeed You Black Emperor covers.
Okay. I'll take that as a compliment.
That's sad and boring.
I mean, it's a sad and boring and transcendental that I'm a big fan of. But yeah, it always has that feel. I don't want to say post-rock because that's quite trite, but it has that feel of like, yeah, that quite analogue Northern Canadian coldness, but also that you do a lot of stuff in black and white and stuff, and it's quite warm in that sense as well. So yeah, I really like your photography, man. So let's not enjoy it.
Cheers, yep. Thanks, guys.
Don't want to leave that on the shelf. So, Sean, you're also friends with Mr. Grant Donaldson.
I am.
It's a tight knit scene here in Glasgow.
Incestuous.
Grant's had a couple of starring roles recently.
Literally two.
The 68. And you're basically here to upstage him, I would assume.
Oh, God. Who can upstage Grant Donaldson? Come on. I wouldn't even try. If I can even, you know, achieve a fraction of what Grant achieved in his two starring roles on the podcast, then I'll be happy.
Right. Well, given that that's your goal, maybe you want to explain what you chose and why.
So the record that I chose is Common Existence by the band Thursday. Released in 2009, it was their fifth record. The reason that I chose it, because it's never the go-to when people talk about Thursday, for like better or for worse, whether they speak positively or negatively about them, it's never the go-to. But for me, it's, I think, the most interesting in their canon, but I also think there's a lot to talk about in relation to the arc that they had as a band. I listened to your REM extravaganza recently.
I've seen it described as a mini series, by the way.
Just by dint of having to break up into so many parts.
The reason why I bring REM up is that there's a sort of handful of bands, you know, maybe, I don't know, five to ten bands, and they are like hills that I'll die on. Mm-hmm. So bands that people sort of turn their noses up at or have like a very particular, quite negative reaction to. REM is one of them. Mm-hmm. Pearl Jam's another. Mm-hmm. Thursday's one of them as well.
Would you die in the Pearl Jam hill?
I would die in the Pearl Jam hill.
I might have a job for you in future.
Records 2 to 5, I will go to bat for them. And, you know, you mention that to people and they're like, pfft.
Let's not go down a Pearl Jam deviation, but I'll save your number.
Okay, excellent. But yeah, Thursday are one of those bands for me where to this day I will defend them like to the hilt, and I think Common Existence is probably, if it's not the hardest one to defend, I think it's the one that shows all of the best aspects and maybe the worst aspects of Thursday. Right. So I thought that would be an interesting one to talk about.
Interesting. So I've got two kind of initial observations. The first is, I'm really looking forward to taking the back seat in the podcast because this is your choice, you're knowledgeable, and Mark, you're a fucking emo screamo head. You know this genre inside out, and I'm like, this is fun. Like, this is, I am literally just gonna, I don't know, toss bombs, pass comments, ask questions, play devil's advocate a wee bit.
Sure.
The other thing is that every so often we do a band on the show that I've always been aware of and never familiarised myself with, especially if they've got a kind of like sizable canon of stuff, and you're like, oh, where did I start? Fuck knows, man. I can't get round to it. Mm-hmm. We've done this a couple of times in the programme, and this is a really good opportunity for me to actually be like, right, finally I can reckon with this. Who's this fucking band that people talk about all the time? And I didn't know up for down in terms of Thursday. Jeff Rickley, the name, familiar. Mm-hmm. We did a thing on United Nations, which we'll talk about in a wee bit. That's connected. But other than that, I mean, I couldn't even have told you before the show, what is their genre? What's a famous song by them? Clearly they're out there in the milieu, but I just had never disambiguated. You know, it's like a big bag of tangled cables and you're like, I'll fucking deal with that later. Yeah. You know what I mean? And you just are perpetually putting that bag of tangled cables to the back of the room. Mm-hmm. So this was a good opportunity for me to disentangle all those cables. And it's been interesting. And I'm glad that you kind of preempted this by kind of explaining why this sort of potentially stuck out as an unsung record. Because I was going to say, like, I'm assuming we wouldn't suggest that the band are unsung.
Well, on you go.
I think that's a complicated thing because, yeah, it often feels like they're ubiquitous in terms of like a band that people will talk about like often, especially in the context of like early 2000s, post-hardcore, screamo, whatever it is they actually are. But I do think that they're a band whose career is characterised by a particular kind of failure. Mm-hmm. And I think from that perspective, I could make the case that they're unsung. So
That's maybe interesting.
Put that there as like a provocation.
Yeah. Also, something I've realised recently as well is that I'm increasingly doing these episodes with one eye on the thought that the person from the band might actually be listening.
That's honestly quite possible with Jeff. I think that's quite possible in this case.
And so,
Hi, Jeff.
It's something. So, what I'm saying is, like, when we say things like a specific kind of failure and stuff like that, I think we've always been reasonably good at it, but I do want to couch it in a way that I would feel comfortable saying to the person anything that I'm going to say in the show. Mm. And that makes the job a wee bit harder when you want to be like a pure shit poster. But I think most of what I'm going to say about this band over the course of this is something that I feel I could say to him. And if that sounds too toned down, or if you don't believe me, then fair enough.
Yeah, I must admit, I'm surprised at this prelude because...
Caveat like fuck.
Yeah, because, you know...
I've been doing that more because, I mean, we did have a couple of mild run-ins and then a couple of positive episodes. People like... I mean, I was always really encouraged by the Codename is Milo episode where I was not overly kind without being mean. Mm-hmm. And they took it in really good spirits and got in touch.
It depends on the personality, right? Like, you can tell those guys are up for a bit of a laugh.
Yeah.
The same for China Drum as well. Like, I don't think we were hugely kind to their early records.
Well, you weren't.
I wasn't, right? But I speak to Jan more than you do. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, and they seem to be a big fan of the pod. So I guess, you know.
I mean, I do think as somebody that's been in a series of failed bands, I have a pretty sort of down to earth when it comes to, you know, hearing criticism and being able to listen to my own stuff and reflect on it. So hopefully we'll try and stick with that ethos.
I would. Sure. I'm going to jump in and just kind of defend Thursday immediately. And like, I don't think you could even remotely call them a failure as a band.
No, I totally agree with you. Continue. Just to make it clear that
I actually can... I'm not sure I'm going to make the same case as Sean, but I do suspect that they were a failure in the eyes of some of the record executives with fucking dollar signs in their pupils who thought we've got the new Nirvana, which is like basically something that we're going to talk about.
That happened to so many bands in that particular era because of that particular era. Yeah. They were failures because they never really, you know, sold them millions and millions of records.
So I don't think it necessarily the band would self-define as that, but I think they would be, you know, in terms of the industry, may well look at them as being like, underachievers.
Supporting My Chemical Romance when they reform, you know, they would still be able to probably sell out the bars here if they play the show. I would still call that fairly successful.
Well, I mean, I have to say, like, my entire lifetime ambition would have been to be a band that could play that sort of bars sized venue.
I mean,
you wouldn't want to get any bigger than that. I just don't see the appeal of getting any bigger than that and being a band. So from my perspective, they're a fucking roaring success.
So I think it's important to say that when I talk about the failures that characterise their career, it is contextual. Mm. You know, I'm in much a similar position as you, Chris, where like the kind of success that they've achieved is something that I could only dream of. But the goalposts change the bigger you get, the more you're promised, or even just like the way that the dynamics within your own band change what your own band is like potentially capable of. Mm-hmm. And why I think Common Existence is a good place to talk about a lot of this. Maybe we can touch on this more later, but if you read, there's a Vice article with Jeff ranking
his own albums. Yeah, I preferred to quit it.
And you know what he says about Common Existence kind of encapsulates the thing that I'm talking about right now. Thursday have probably been are in the best health that they've probably ever been, with the exception of like 2003. You know, I'm going to see them at Outbreak. I was probably going to go to Outbreak anyway, but as soon as I saw that they were playing, I immediately just bought a ticket. I've not seen them since 2003. You know, I've got so much love for them, and I just want to make it really clear that when I talk about failure in this context, it is in relation to, like, I guess the public-facing aspects of the band, what they did achieve versus what they maybe wanted to achieve, all the things that happened along the way. And it's like, it's a pretty wild tale. I think especially...
Oh man, there's some really odd twists and turns in this. I had to double take on a couple of things, now, you also put us on to a documentary that was really useful. So, and for my own research, I watched a fair bit of interview footage. I also used an interview, which I think was from about 2011, and it was recorded the day after they announced they were breaking up, and it was with Jeff, and that was actually a really interesting interview. There was a lot of like really just useful little bits of trivia in there, and I've kind of referred to that a bit. We'll get into it though. The old school kind of origins of this band, I mean, in terms of the membership, clearly Jeff Rickley is the face of this band, the king of the centre parting, I will add.
King, both in terms of hair and teeth.
Yes, by the way, as a kid that grew up with a massive gap in my front teeth, which I fucking hated and got it fixed at great discomfort, I sympathise with that. Also, somewhat cruelly labelled Tone Jeff, as I discovered. And I think that's something that's definitely stung the boy wee bit over the years.
Definitely.
As regards to other members in the band, what, Tucker?
Tucker Rule, drummer.
Drummer. Yep. Basically learned drums to play on Thursday, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how I saw it depicted.
That's right.
Tom Keeley on guitar.
Yep.
Started playing when he was 17. This is another thing, actually, that I see. There's quite a lot of things about Thursday that I relate to. And I started quite late, you know, in terms of picking up an instrument as well. So started at 17 and he kind of knew stuff like Nirvana. I was much the same. There was an interesting bit in that documentary where he said that at the start, Jeff didn't like him very much. And then it's immediately followed by Jeff saying that he wanted this guy to be in the band because he liked him so much, he wanted to be around him.
And
it's interesting how the perspectives were so different on the same thing. Then another Tom on bass,
Tim Payne.
Tim Payne. And he came from a background of playing stuff like My Bloody Valentine and indie sort of things like that. Some of the early influences and name checks that I saw cropping up in some of their interviews, but Ink and Dagger was one that a lot of people referred to. Yep. Actually, one particular performance gets a lot of emphasis. Seemed to be a really pivotal band. Tucker describes their music in a couple of places as having a sloshy feel, which is a dead weird word to use, but you know what, I kind of get what it means, because there's a lot of looseness, there's a lot of drift and cacophony. And Ink and Dagger had that way more than Thursday do. I mean, Thursday are much tighter by comparison. Ink and Dagger were quite a ramshackle post-hardcore band. It was quite bouncing off the walls, rackety. And yeah, I totally get that. Yet, Tucker then says that Thursday were kind of hoping to try and emulate part of that, but with like Hot Water Music sing-alongs on top.
There's a lot of that in like the guitar interplay. You know, you get that kind of Hot Water Music kind of breaking down chords and all that, and you know, kind of just doing slightly interesting picky parts together, which is actually one of the things, like when they actually got a keyboard player like full time later on, that actually really helps to make that sound even fuller, because it lets them go away and be even more interesting without having to worry about filling up the whole spectrum, you know, which was a really, really clever compositional choice on their part, I think.
Let's talk about New Brunswick and Basements.
Yeah, we've talked about that before. Lifetime.
Yeah, they have. So they're from New Brunswick, and again, to emphasise, that's a city in New Jersey, not the Canadian province. Jeff, from a young age, was a big fan of this kind of DIY sort of basement show scene, and he actually went on to host loads and loads of these shows in his own place.
Including Lifetime.
And that was like, it seems in those early days, that was kind of the extent of their expectations as young musicians. It was like they just wanted to share a stage with these musicians and bands that they really enjoyed and respected, and that was kind of it. It was like, let's just do that and then we'll just see what happens.
Like Lifetime.
that was Jeff's entire impetus of being in a band, was just to like be able to play his own basement shows, right?
Yeah.
I think is a really important thing to bear in mind, again, when we talk about the arc of the band and what I would perceive as like failures, or what they would perceive as failures, because you're right, they had very, very low expectations of what the band could possibly achieve, which I think is really interesting. And while when I was in my teens, that wasn't really my goal with being in a band, when you think back on it, that is the most fun part probably of being in a band. You know, you're young enough to like not care about anything else. Yeah. You're just playing like these awful like dives and maybe in your hometown, and you're seeing like these bands that you really love and respect, and you feel like you're part of something. So yeah, I think that's
Absolutely. Now, Mark, you've mentioned Lifetime quite a bit. We did the Lifetime album, Jersey's Best Dancers, way, way back. There's a track in that called Theme Song for a New Brunswick Basement Show. Jeff has kind of quoted that as being something like their anthem, and understandably so. Another band from New Brunswick, Bouncing Souls. They had started touring before Thursday kind of became a band, and Jeff was describing how they were kind of local heroes as a bit of an inspiration to like, you can do this, you can come from here, you can go out and play these shows. Also, I didn't notice, apparently Bouncing Souls had a bit of a local reputation for being like crazy party animals and throwing toilets off roofs and stuff like that at house parties and things like that.
Their drummer's now the Hot Water Music drummer, George Bello.
And then Jeff mentions quite frequently another band from New Brunswick who got a bit passed over, but they're called You and I. And they're from between 1996 and 1999. Kind of screamy post-hardcore with bits of, they're a bit noisier, there's a bit more chaos in the music. Jeff says that a lot of what they were doing was what Thursday were trying to emulate. He knew that Thursday wouldn't get as raw or as heavy as that, but he wanted to try and capture the sort of energy and the edginess of those performances. One of Thursday's first shows was one of You and I's last, and I think actually You and I's last ever show was in his basement. There's plenty of stuff up by You and I on Bandcamp if you want to go and check them out. They're free downloads as well, so, you know, fire in.
I think they've had a bit of a resurgence recently as well, because, like, that kind of late 90s scrams has, like, had a big resurgence in the kind of, like, dying days of Bandcamp as we know it. So
proper screamo.
Jeff, actually, I think he lived with members of that band for a while, and Tom from You and I did the Screaming on the Full Claps album. So he was kind of drafted in as a sort of surrogate member and mentor, I think is the word that was used.
Even I didn't know that.
There you go. Can we just pause to note how many Toms and Tims there were in New Brunswick at this point, by the way?
So many, I know.
Come on, mums.
You also had, from that same scene, you had like Streetlight Manifesto, Midtown, Enzin, Screaming Females were all kicking around at the same time. And of course, how can you forget about Bon Jovi? the biggest band from New Brunswick.
Bon Jovi?
And the Gaslight Anthem are now, or they were from there as well. That was later.
Of course, much later. Yeah, because we did. Yeah, we mentioned that when we did their episode as well. So I mean, going back to that 2011 interview, Jeff talks a lot about a later resurgence as well of that very DIY emo screamo scene, gigs and basements and bookshops and art galleries and stuff that we've done and seen and been at, Sean, and played at, and I'm sure you're the same, Mark. He refers to a couple of bands like La Dispute. And Touche Amore has been bands that sort of cited Thursday.
The Wave, that was called.
The Wave.
What a ridiculous name.
As being bands that were inspired by them. And like, not long after, I mean, this interview was 2011. I think those bands started to break through in 2009.
It was pretty soon. Before.
And I think Touche Amore was released by Rickley's Collect Records, wasn't it? But all that comes is empty promises. It was like, because he always did co-releases initially, and that was a co-release on them. So we should probably mention Collect Records, because this is where one of the most interesting immediate bits of trivia pops up. A guy called Martin Shkreli, who was a silent investor in that label. So Martin Shkreli, you probably know that name, because he was persona non grata basically everywhere in 2015 around a kind of inflated prices scandal for toxoplasmosis medication. And remember a lot about this?
I remember it
very, very well. Because
you had toxoplasmosis?
I remember getting a phone call from my friend Nick.
Can I just ask, is this the thing you get off cats?
Yes.
It is, but I thought it was an AIDS medication.
Is it?
Yeah, that was.
Or was toxoplasmosis one of the comorbidities of AIDS? Maybe it makes you more susceptible.
Maybe, but it was. I was sure that it was a treatment for AIDS, and that was why, the price hiking scandal was so wild. Mm. But when that news broke, I remember my good friend Nick, who is very good friends with Jeremy from Touché, telling me about why that would be such a problem that Martin Shkreli was all over the news for possibly some bands in the kind of post-hardcore screamo world. Mm-hmm. Because, obviously, as you said, Martin Shkreli was a silent investor in Collect Records, which was Jeff Rickley's record label, and it was like the kind of crossover scandal that you just don't see coming at all.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it?
Really, really wild.
So apparently Shkreli had bought the guitar that was used to record Full Collapse for $10,000, mm-hmm. and that's how they initially kind of crossed paths. And then supposedly the estimates are that he invested almost $1 million into that label. Mm-hmm. So when he withdrew that amount, well, they had to do something about it. They had to address the issue. Loads of the bands were up in arms about it. And it was only about 48 hours before Rickley came out and said, look, we're going to be ending our association with Martin Shkreli, and the funding was removed. But the funding being removed really affected the label's solvency. Mm-hmm. And so that was in 2015. The last actual releases were Wax Idols and No Devotion in 2015. We'll come back to No Devotion. and the label formally ended in 2018, I think it was,
when it
wrapped up. Yeah, yeah, so I mean, it was still selling and ticking over, but it didn't release anything subsequent to 2015. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's a really odd collision of worlds, isn't mm-hmm. it? And I mean, he was, pardon the pun, but toxic. You know, mm-hmm. he really was, his fucking face was on dartboards across the planet.
Yep. And he's in jail now, right?
Yeah, yeah.
For fraud?
This is the problem. I don't want to say because I'm guessing here, but yeah, there was some fucking ridiculous measure that he tried to take to get out of this or something like that.
Got me a Google.
No, fuck it. He's a prick. Jeff Rickley, though, we've mentioned him quite a bit, and we should talk about him because he's a big character whilst also being, I don't say a small character, but being quite a humble guy, being quite a down-to-earth, natural, likeable dude. At least he comes across mm-hmm. really quite well. A couple of things about him. He's a self-medicating depressive, I think is one tactful way to put it. We'll unpack that a wee bit. And he's also a diagnosed epileptic, which caused a lot of issues with touring as well. I mean, fucking hell, being an epileptic in a band, playing festivals and small venues and trying to get word to the fucking lighting engineer, you know, I mean, that kind of shit is just, that's a nightmarish ailment to have in that industry. Yeah. And I have to say, watching the footage and listening to a couple of podcasts of Jeff Rickley speaking, I find, as I mentioned this before, I find the story of Thursday and the perspectives of Jeff in particular, really highly relatable. I think one of them, so he's an only child. Mm-hmm. I think a couple of the guys in the band were only children. Mm-hmm. I'm an only child.
Me too.
And, so one thing, and I genuinely only really put this together within the last year, but my approach to being in bands almost became like a surrogate family thing, you know.
Absolutely.
You spend intensive amounts of time in close proximity. You're kind of interdependent. You go on these trips, you know, seeing all these different parts of the world, and you always remember those in reference to these other people. There's a sharing, there's a commonality, a mm-hmm. sense of shared experience in there. And he talks about how the band became a surrogate family, a proxy for that companionship that you don't have as an only child a lot of the time. And actually, I found that really poignant because that is, as I say, only something I've put my finger on. Like, why was my approach to being in bands always so different to a lot of the guys that I played with? Who were like, they saw a band as like, that's my band. It's my family. That's my band. But I never had that same hard boundary between those two. And it seems to be a big part of only children getting into like really tight-knit bands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally agree. Really felt like that a lot in my sort of teens and 20s when I was like, when being in a band was like my only creative outlet. You do form these like bonds with people that as you grow up and you change, you might no longer have those. They might not be people you would choose to spend your time with, but you have this like common thing of like being in a band together. But I think it's also the reason why that when bands break up, they can break up in such spectacularly messy ways, because you kind of have this
there's a lot of rejection involved. Yeah. It's this is the thing as well, it's not always symmetrical. It can be incredibly personal for one party and actually quite transactional for the other, which again just exacerbates that sense of acrimony.
And I guess as well, when you have that shared experience and you're all pulling in this direction where you're all trying to like achieve this dream, you know, we all think of, you know, if you're in a band, there's like the dream of like making it, being successful, making money from it, or even just being like popular, making like the music you want to make, but because you have that shared experience, it often also allows the kind of animosity that friends would maybe deal with in particular ways resolve or like separate when separate, the friendship wasn't working. You kind of let a lot of that stuff slide, and I guess at the point where you are no longer like family, that can just become quite explosive. And as far as I can tell, that never happened with Thursday.
Yeah, and that's actually nice, because that's one of the encouraging things about that story, is that he lays that out, talks about that development of a sense of brotherhood, and it maintains, by and large, at least as far as I can tell. Certainly, you hear a lot of stories to the contrary of that. I've experienced a few of them myself, where you end up just, something just breaks down, and it just seems to break down in a way that is just extra catastrophic when you've put so much more emphasis on the importance of it in your own subconscious. Like, that's the thing, you're not aware of doing it, you know, but that need for things to work, that need for it to feel special and important, and then one day you realise, oh, this doesn't mean the same to them as it means to me. So I think it was actually quite an encouraging part of Thursday that they managed to maintain those bonds and seem to still have those bonds.
With the possible exception of Andrew Everding, their keyboard player, who seems to, certainly since 2020, when the kind of initial reformation, he's been quite absent. And I did my internet sleuthing, and he's the only member of the band, like sort of past or present, who doesn't follow Jeff on Instagram.
All right.
And the only references I can find to
Andrew...
Does
he have an Instagram?
He does, right, and he follows some of the other members of Thursday.
All right.
But he doesn't follow Jeff. And Jeff is the most like active member of Thursday on social media as well. So, I mean, I don't know, pure speculation, and you don't know where people's lives take them. But as far as I know,
you heard it here first, folks.
This is now a gossip podcast. Yeah. He was supposed to be involved in the sort of like...
Do you have a column in the Daily Record?
I've got a column in the Digger, mate.
You're that cunt with a bike helmet. Right. Yeah, I mean, I really found some of their interview stuff quite touching, and they were obviously a very honest band. Jeff in particular is very honest. And another way he was very honest is about his heroin use. So talking about self-medication... He originally was self-medicating we'll say inverted commas, lighter drugs, but it graduated to heroin use. I did listen to him talking about how he actually got onto heroin, and it was to do with he had a stash of pills, and he was onto pills, and he lost them and was basically starting to withdraw and bought heroin, thinking this might help. But then he said that he just sat and sort of stared at it for days because he wasn't really ready to do it. But obviously the withdrawal would be kicking in. And he said he like literally sat and weighed it up. Like, do I take this, or is this just the moment to just kill myself? Like, is this just the time to just opt out? And actually, you know, his candid discussion of that, he's done it a few times. And he's obviously a guy that's had many a dark night of the soul.
Yeah.
But yeah, fascinating guy. I mean, again, we're going to talk about, you know, the new Cobain thing. I think his troubles with substance abuse were almost kind of romanticised by some people, you know, adds to the intensity and the, you know, enigmatic nature of some of his art. How has he fared over the years? I've not been following Thursday, but have there been periods of inaction that have been attributed to him struggling?
I don't actually think so. I think 2011 was when the heroin addiction really took off, from what I understand, and then I don't think he kicked it until 2015 or 16. But in between, he was putting out solo music No Devotion, a lot of that activity took place in that time as well, because, well, Ian Watkins, we'll get to that.
Yes.
But we'll get to that.
Yeah.
Spoke his name.
A fucking big dirty elephant in the room.
There is a big dirty elephant in the room. So a lot of that activity kind of took place during that time period. So he was still active. Full disclosure, so I met Jeff when he was doing his solo stuff. He played at the ABC 2 in 2014 with...
Rest in peace.
I know, RIP. With Koji and...
Koji, yeah.
Oh, I can't remember the name of the other guy. He was like an English singer-songwriter. And
Ed Sheeran?
It's not Frank Turner.
It wasn't either of those.
We don't ever remember Frank Turner's name in this podcast.
Absolute rockets. No, it wasn't them. I can't remember who the third act was, but anyway, it was being promoted by Stephen Hill, Strugglestown Records. Big shout out to Stephen. Mm-hmm. And
top bloke.
Is a top bloke. And the bands needed somewhere to stay. So... I had a flat, I was living by myself, I had some space. Stephen asked if they could crash with me, and I was like, that's absolutely fine. Inside, going absolutely mental. Because,
totally, man. Fucking hell.
You know, Jeff Rickley was going to be sleeping on my floor, sleeping on my couch. He wrote actually a really compelling book called Someone Who Isn't Me about his struggles with addiction. I read it a couple of months ago. Would recommend if you find him to be even remotely a compelling character. It's well written. I've got some problems with it, but generally speaking, in terms of the kind of books that maybe singers and those kind of bands would write, it's really, really good. Mm-hmm. But what it let me identify was that when Jeff was sleeping on my couch, he was definitely in the throes of his heroin addiction. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I wouldn't have been able to say. He was a bit distracted and a bit jittery, but like, he seems like quite a distracted and jittery guy. That's kind of part of his persona.
Yeah, yeah.
Very earnest, very sincere, but also like kind of like a kid. Do you know what I mean? So I didn't really think much of it at the time. And then I read the book and I was like, oh my God, like when I met Jeff, he must have been kind of in the throes of this really, really terrible addiction. So judging by the book, he didn't fare very well. I think it was a really, really dark time in the guy's life. Mm-hmm. But he kind of managed to stay functioning. High functioning
is that kind of, that's the word I was going to throw in there. It's like a functional addict, and I'm sure he would probably beg to differ at many points. Mm-hmm. But being able to hold down a band, being able to see through the tours without the tours collapsing, in that sort of like Cobain and Rome sort of fashion, you know. Mm-hmm. There is a level of functionality there, respect, to be able to do it for years and then to get past it and emerge out the other side. Mm-hmm. You know, thank goodness. It is fascinating, as you say, that it didn't make itself really obvious to you, even though you were in that kind of like close proximity, but to find that out later, that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I don't get starstruck, but it was a really big deal to be like hanging out with a guy whose music I've really, really loved for, I mean, at that point, it was like 12 years. Mm-hmm. You know, at this point, we're talking 20 years. So it might have been, I might have been a little bit blinded by that.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I mean, I would like to be very clear that, like, I don't know Jeff, you know, apart from that interaction, him saying my couch, like,
you're not making any claims on your best buds.
No. But my interactions with him were nothing but positive. Mm. I had a really, really nice time hanging out with him, and he was very gracious and very tidy, very respectful.
That's a good sign.
Absolutely, because we know what those touring musicians can be like.
They are the fucking worst.
So I had nothing but positive interactions with him. But yeah, by all accounts, he was really in the depths of something, I think, when I met him. So,
just a wee note for listeners, by the way, if you are in a touring band, number one priority is be the touring band that does the dishes, wipes the toilet seat, uses the toilet brush. Just be that fucking band. Mm-hmm. Honestly, people will just speak so glowingly of you.
Do you guys, this is a bit of a digression, do you guys remember Vessels?
I love Vessels, man.
Yeah, me too. Vessels, good pals of mine, when they used to play in Glasgow, she used to play up here
quite
a lot.
Future episode, by the way.
I'd be, well up for that. They used to play in Glasgow quite a lot, and they would stay at my flat. And
remember they played around the corner when it was Captain Dressed?
Yep. Yeah, I was there. Anyway, they are by far the best touring band that I've ever had stay at my house. I went out to work at 8 the morning after the show, and when I came back, they had cleaned... not just tidied, cleaned my entire flat.
That's amazing.
And I'll never forget that. So, yeah.
Rearranged the spice cover. And
I think they sort of did like do a full number on the kitchen. It was amazing.
They seem a bit Oxfordshire. That's quite, I mean.
They're very polite.
Yeah.
But yeah, what you said is true. Like, just
Be that band.
Just be that band.
Oh, man. I mean, that was like, we were a well-drilled unit and we were so courteous on tour. Like, we always left that house at least as nice, if not nicer, than when we got there. So, yeah. Anyway, Jeff had a couple of, like, really interesting incidents. He was mugged in 2013, lost his rent, his phone, and what is euphemistically titled medication, but mm-hmm. it was basically his drugs. Mm-hmm. And also, fucking hell, 2015, he was poisoned in Hamburg and then robbed. Mm-hmm. And I was reading this, I was going, wait a minute, should I be reading between the lines here? And it turns out there was like, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to Hamburg. I really like Hamburg. The Reeperbahn area, I think it was at the Rock Cafe in St. Pauli. And supposedly they said that his drink was drugged, and then he was followed as he was like really succumbing to whatever it was in his drink, and they mugged him and robbed him. And seemingly there was a bit of a spate of this going on. Mm-hmm. It's fucking nightmarish, man. I mean, the Reeperbahn is chaos. Like, it's wild, but even knowing how wild it is, that's pretty shocking. And it's mostly fucking Brits as well. Mm-hmm. It's fucking stag doos. It's like the budget stag do destination because you can fly direct. It was so many Scottish voices, total redneck. However, fantastic city. I'm not shitting on Hamburg. Cool. Absolutely love Hamburg. Arguably the nicest city in Germany. I'm putting that out there. Cool. But anyway, pressing
we
on.
We should go to Hamburg and interview Jacob's there.
Yes, that's where the Jacob's are from. Man, honestly, I've got a lot of time for that place. I saw that band Big Brave in Hamburg.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, last time I went.
Just on the topic of the mugging, like Jeff Rickley's mugging in Hamburg, am I not right in saying that was also 2 days after the collapse of Collect Records?
Was it?
Yeah, it happened like...
What, a week?
Because he found out about the Martin Shkreli drugs price hiking when he got off the plane to tour Germany with No Devotion. So he got off the plane, turned his phone back
on. And he was in No Devotion. And he what was a in, nightmare.
Oh my God, brutal.
He's listening.
but yeah, that his phone blew up like with messages when he turned it back on, which was like, have you seen this? Martin's all over the news. I think that's the kind of sort of catastrophe, like disaster, failure that sort of recurs all the way throughout. And I think that's more what I'm trying to get at. There's always something really dramatic having happened.
Fate seems to intervene a lot in that. So we've mentioned Cobain a few times, and I think there was definitely a recurring narrative that when Thursday were on the way up, when they brought out that second record especially, there was a sense of like, oh, is this it? Is this the arrival of the emo Nirvana? Is it arrived? Do we have a new Cobain figure, like a troubled, edgy? I mean, you're saying obviously his heroin addiction wasn't an issue at that point, mm-hmm. but there was a sense of this quite deep, thoughtful, slightly melancholy, but live they were very energetic and confrontational and exciting. And there was definitely a sense of labels being like, could this be the one? I mean, it was like Victory Records they were on.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
I think they thought that they had a Nirvana on their hands.
Yeah, yeah. So they were on Eyeball Records for the first record, and then Victory got them for the second.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was all of a sudden this huge amount of buzz around them off the back of understanding a car crash. The first proper song on Foot Collapse second record.
The one that even I know.
Yeah. Labels just started going nuts for them. I think especially between the second and third records, the success of Foot Collapse kind of catapulted them into this world that these sort of screamo kids from New Brunswick basements just were not prepared for. And Jeff became the absolute lightning rod for a lot of that stuff, which... And this is no disrespect to him, because I do find him really compelling and really interesting, and I love his music. But, you know, I was listening to them in 2003, and even at the time I was like, I don't get this.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I don't see that.
No.
At all. You know, it's not the band that has, they don't have a hook anywhere near as big as a lot of their contemporaries had tonight either.
I mean, I guess from the perspective of, if you listen to their contemporaries, which I know that, Mark, that you do, and I did a lot when I was younger, and some of them to this day, I still think there's something going on with Thursday that isn't present in most of their peers. Something that is a lot sort of more melancholic, less, I don't know, Chris, you'll probably roll your eyes at this, but like less angsty. It's not angst, it's something else. It's a bit, maybe a bit darker. There is something present in the music and in Jess lyrics, maybe, but it's not Cobain.
I mean, I think Thursday feel less contrived than a lot of the bands that were around at that point. I would say like Finch is an example. Like, mm-hmm. Finch feel a little bit contrived to me. That said, I think Finch have some really big hooks and a couple of really big singles that Thursday probably didn't have.
Yeah.
But I think Thursday feel like a real band. They feel like a real deal.
I think, you know, what would the closest contemporaries be to this band? Probably Glassjaw and Thrice. Probably the two other really big bands in the era, because Thrice made a jump to a major at the same time.
Yep.
I think it was the same label. Was it Island as well? I think they were also on
it
Island.
It was, yeah, yeah.
And then Glassjaw went right to Roadrunner, then went right on to Warner Brothers, you know what I mean? And so I guess when War All the Time came out, they had their second record as well. And yeah, it's weird because all three of those bands, none of them ever really got...
Yeah, but that scene, like, doesn't have big hooks.
That's what I was going to say. Well,
it's stylistic, but it does... I mean, don't get me wrong, it's got anthems for the kids and the folk that were into it, but it doesn't have big enduring hooks. It's not got a timeless quality in the sense that, you know, like Weezer has a timeless quality. Some of the stuff that is a lot more, let's say, lowbrow... has a timeless quality. That scene is, it's a kind of bit of a lifestyle thing. It's an attitude, it's an energy, it's what's going on, it's engaging with your inner fucking like turbulence, you know, but it's not got the big enduring hooks, even of like the grunge era, which was, you know, it was known for a lot of the same things, engaging with your inner sort of demons and all that kind of stuff. But then it also had Black Hole Sun, and it had fucking like Jeremy, and it had fucking Dirt, and it had Cobain, obviously, and then even it had like these peripheral things like Smashing Pumpkins and Hole and all that kind of stuff. Huge, huge hooks that were just going to last and last. And that scene, I just don't feel, as much as there were beloved tunes within there, they didn't have that lasting appeal. And I include Glassjaw in that. I mean, fucking hell. I mean, Beating Heart Baby totally outstrips anything.
Kid Automatica, that is.
That Glassjaw ever achieved in terms of like enduring legacy. I get it, and Glassjaw are loved.
Okay, Chris.
They're loved, but that is a fucking banger.
I mean, Beating Heart Baby is
an absolute classy song.
It's top shelf.
It is incredible, and undoubtedly.
As much as people love Glassjaw, and I know a lot of people that love Glassjaw, but what fucking Glassjaw are you sticking on in a club
now? You know, it took until one of the bands that Jeff produced, My Chemical Romance, to have like the monster hooks.
Yeah.
You know, the stadium
film. It did come.
It took a while for it to get
there.
This era
have monster hooks. It really didn't. I know it was big. I know it's very fondly thought of, but it just, as an outsider to it, I'm just being objective. It didn't have monster hooks.
And I guess the only other bands I think that maybe had really big hooks, they used... They had two songs with like fucking huge choruses, which is far bigger than anything.
Yeah, but where are they now, though? They're not
exactly.
They're not in that kind of pantheon of like great hooky bands.
Yeah, they're definitely not. They had like a they're not a good band.
So in terms of like people looking to replace Nirvana, I mean, this was an enduring thing from, like, I mean, literally from the point that Nirvana got big, there were already bands trying to be Nirvana when Nirvana were still alive. But certainly from like 94 when Kurt died through the mid 90s, it was just a constant thing. And some really on the nose examples from that era that I would use would be like Everclear, Silverchair. A little bit later, you had like the Vines, they were definitely trying to be Nirvana. But the later 90s.
Nickelback, you've totally missed Nickelback. Well, there, mate.
Yeah, no, it's true. Although they were a bit of a misjudged one. And I think it's similar to Bush. Like with Bush, Gavin Rossdale, they weren't really trying to make another Kurt Cobain because he was a wee bit closer to Johnny Depp than he was to Kurt Cobain. It was sort of like a pretty boy thing. And I know loads of people fancied Kurt.
He's starting his Bush defence again.
I would like to point out that I'm with Chris on this.
Team Bush.
Team Bush.
I have no horse in the race, but like, there's an episode coming down the line where Bush is going to feature
Ben Power
quite heavily.
Is fucking going into conniptions right now because he's 100% in for Silverchair. Yeah. Anyway, so late 90s, you had obviously Fred Durst, Marilyn Manson, not even late 90s, but you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. By the late 90s, you had Marilyn Manson, Eminem, like they had taken over, and people weren't looking for the new Cobain at that point, but it did come back around, and it came back around a lot, I feel, with Thursday, that early 2000s period. Folk were like, we need to find another fucking Nirvana, we need another Kurt Cobain figure that unites a generation. And I mean, are there any others? And I mean specifically from that 2000s scene, because I'm going to then mention 2010s, but is there anybody for the 2000s that you think was sort of trying to be moulded?
Do you know, I was thinking about this really seriously over the last couple of days, because we talked a little bit about it before, to like think about this. I really cannot think of anyone who even got a sniff of that kind of epithet.
I don't think they got off the boards. Yeah.
No.
I definitely don't think there's that. I mean, as absurd as it seems in hindsight, even like Brian Molko, people were trying to like get that icon with that controversial, troubled icon thing. I mean, it really wouldn't stick at this point, though. I found that there was an article in the Diffuser magazine, and I mean, it's painfully of its time, but it then analysed like the bands of like the 2010s, and some of the ones that they came up with, Zachary Cole Smith, is it Div? Dive?
Dive, yeah.
Dive. And he had that kind of added factor of he was going to be that girl Sky Ferreira.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And so you had that kind of celebrity couple thing. Is it my imagination, or were they the band that had some mad controversy?
That's ringing a bell, but I never got into Dive. I'm thinking something fashy, was it?
I don't even know the band. So.
No, I mean, well, anyway, I thought there was some kind of PR atrocity, but Dylan Baldy from Cloud Nothings, he was another one that Diffuser had picked out. Mm-hmm. He even, you know, they went and did the Albini recording thing. Mm-hmm. Nathan Williams from Waves, now he did, I think they did have some kind of like brush with cancellation. Mm-hmm. So much fucking indie landfill in this list, by the way. Yeah. But you know, he liked his pills and he liked pissing off crowds. He was a wee bit edgy. Then, I mean, other people at that time that they were trying to foist upon us as being this kind of icon. You had Christopher Owens of the band Girls. He had been in some kind of religious cult with his family. I think he ended up in Eastern Europe. His mum went into prostitution. It was some sort of quasi-tragic story.
Wow.
And they'd kind of held him up as being this, you know, maybe this will be the voice of a generation. I mean, they even started going for like people like Ty Segall, who, I mean, when he clocked these sort of comparisons, he was like, I think it's just the hair. Kurt Vile as well, who really, pretty tenuous at that point. But it's been a constant thing since the start of the 90s to try and find Kurt Cobain. Who is this blue-eyed guy that will look pained into a camera and unite a generation and elicit the passion that he managed to do? All these disenfranchised kids that can't give voice to their inner turmoil and the fact that they're misfits. Who is this person that's going to do that? And there was definitely a sense from that second album into the third album that maybe Jeff Rickley, maybe Thursday were going to provide.
Yeah, had the same kind of momentum and just about to write a good hook, feeling that Nirvana had from Bleach, which they just didn't capitalise on. We were all the time. And I think Jeff Rickley's on record as saying like that wasn't really, like, they deliberately went in to make a record that wasn't that catchy on a major label because he would have found it wasn't complex enough to be satisfying to him otherwise, you know?
So I think, going back to what you were saying about that era not having like hooks in the way that like grunge did, what I've always thought with Thursday, and I guess with bands of their ilk that I do really like even Glassjaw, it's not really about craft. It's not really about like...
different kind of craft.
But it's not about like the craft of like songwriting craft. It's not about writing the perfect version of the thing that they're going for. But it is about ideas. And with Thursday, like, they do something that I often find like quite difficult, where they do like, I hate a tempo change, like really hate a tempo change as a rule. And Thursday do stuff like that quite a lot, or they'll do like a bizarre key change, or go from like 4-4 to 6-4 for a reason that doesn't really seem that obvious. They kind of make it work, but it's obviously not about crafting this perfect, ideal 3.5-4 minute long rock song. It's about putting these ideas in and then bringing like Jeff's lyrical ideas and putting that on top of it or whatever.
Yeah, because I mean, that's the kind of thing that makes an executive at, you know, Geffen, Virgin, Warner just fucking despair, because they're like, oh no, stick with the 4-4, we almost had the single. And it's almost a slight bit of sabotage, and I admire that integrity. I do like that, especially when it works. That's my caveat. If you're out to be the next big thing, you're not really doing shit like that, really, because it confuses the punters. It does. I mean, you can get a certain amount of success, but if you start throwing in odd timings and tempo changes, your success tends to have a ceiling. And yeah, so clearly they weren't, you know, writing for that. And that must have fucking... that must have pissed off a lot of people who'd already sort of like taken it, made a down payment on their new car.
Yes.
It's an interesting sort of philosophical thing to ponder, right? Because you're taking the major label deal partly to get away from your Victory, which it turns out they end up having a good relationship with after everything happened anyway, because I think they speak quite highly of their time there now, and the guy for Victory also does, even though when they were in the throes of War All the Time, it was like...
yeah, I mean, when they were getting off that label, it was messy.
But they've taken that deal, and you'd have to be a total idiot to not realise what's supposed to come next there, right? You're supposed to write. You're supposed to write the big songs. That's what they're expecting you.
Yes, though, because there's plenty of like evidence to the contrary. And you know,
I'm not saying that they're wrong for doing it. I'm just saying that I think philosophically it's quite interesting to take that, especially in an era when everything on the radio is big and hooky, and money's being chucked around right, left, and centre, and it's a total feeding frenzy. I admire the fact they didn't do it. They didn't write the big hooks, but I think it's interesting philosophically just to ponder like.
But what I mean is, I get what you're saying, actually, I agree, but I'm just saying that, you know, we're all good at deluding ourselves, right? And you can tell yourself, oh, we're not going to be this band, we're going to be this band. So let's take an example like Sonic Youth. Sonic Youth went on to a major label and then made some of their best music, and it was fucking obtuse, you know what I mean? And so you're kind of telling yourself, well, okay, cautionary tale, Nirvana, whatever. But, you know, and even then, I mean, Nirvana went and fucking did In Utero. You know, if you're in a band and you take that major label deal and you are still looking to try and record stuff that is, I would say, legitimate, it's not the word.
Challenging to you,
fulfilling, you know, creatively, I think you will tell yourself, well, you know, we won't be this band. We won't be the sellout band. We will be the band that sort of stuck with our principles. And even going back to the 90s, you had examples of that. Jawbox were on a major, and fucking Helmet were on a major.
Shudder to Think's my go-to, yep, always.
Exactly. So I think you can convince yourself that it is possible. But yeah, invariably, the people that run those labels, thinking they've maybe just signed this, you know, goose that lays the golden egg, it's unavoidable they would be a little bit disappointed. And Thursday, you know, fair fucks to them for sticking with their craft, with their art, with their integrity. But there must have been some like disgruntled board meetings.
Well, in that documentary, the Kill the House Lights, which I want to talk about a wee bit more actually, because there's a couple of really interesting things about that. But in that documentary, you see their A&R guy from Ireland, so he's talking about signing them on the back of Full Collapse, and basically just been like, you know, he's saying with a total straight face, like, we told them, just come to Ireland, we will give you the money to just be the band that you are, but we'll, you know, we'll ramp up your budgets, you can come, you can make whatever music you want to make, we're really excited, we think you're going to be the next big thing, you're already in an upward trajectory, we just want to facilitate that. So then the band go and record War All the Time. they turn it into that guy, and he's like, nah, there's no singles on this, you need to go back into the studio.
Exactly.
And then when the next phase of that happens, where they are trying to get off of Ireland, his demeanour changes. I mean, it's all obviously recorded after the fact, but him recalling it, his demeanour changes, and then he starts sort of talking shit on the band, starts like making comments about how they can't communicate with each other, and how everything is melodramatic. And it was really, I think it's really interesting to watch that guy, who is a pure agent of music industry capitalism,
absolutely
able to tell them, you can just be the band that you are because that's what we want, until you don't turn a single in for us, and then you're all pricks.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be so many signed musicians rolling their eyes at that because they've all heard that. Ah, you just be you. You just write your songs, knowing that that is not worth the fucking paper it's printed on. Like, you don't mean that.
It's a white pony effect, right? It's like turning white pony. Like, you've not got a single, and then they go and write, you know, back to school.
Right, guys. I think we will wrap the first part of this side A up here. We'll come roaring back in with a couple of interesting facts about Thursday in the next episode, and then we'll have a wee skim through their catalogue and get dug into the main event, followed by a really rather delicious Nexus. I think you'll agree. Sean, how you feeling?
Feeling good.
Yeah.
Excited to be talking about a band that I deeply love that people often give me shit for.
So great. Far, so good. I don't think Thursday will have switched off yet. They might have punched a wall, but they're probably still listening. So
they will have heard worse.
Yes.
All right, guys. See you shortly.
Bye.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, didn't see that coming, and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.